Hi, this is Lisa Gar, inviting you to join me every Wednesday and Thursday at 1 o'clock for The Aware Show, as we continue to bring you cutting-edge interviews about health, spirituality, and self-awareness. That's every Wednesday and Thursday, 1 o'clock on The Aware Show.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
The series tells the story of how disasters like wildfires, the COVID-19 pandemic, and hurricanes have affected the most vulnerable. The series hosts, Chriselle Palais and Rose Arrieta, met through a network of grassroots advocates working on issues of racial justice, housing, and land. For years, they've been on the front lines of crises that have threatened their communities in Texas and California.
As long as disaster recovery does not intentionally address the plight of people of color, and those neglected during the last disaster, and the ones before that, then we're going to continue to face a greater distortion in how communities truly recover.
This series also shows how those most affected have organized recovery and how they're rebuilding toward a more just, equitable future.
By law, you have no choice but to provide safe, sanitary living conditions to these tenants under your own regulations, by the way.
Here's Chriselle to start us off.
In August of 2020, Rose and I spoke with my colleague in Houston, Zoe Middleton. All three of us work on housing justice in our cities, and we were catching up on what was happening 6 months into the pandemic. Rose and her neighbors in San Francisco were experiencing heavy smoke from the wildfires to the north, while Zoe and I were awaiting yet another tropical storm heading for the Gulf Coast.
Right now, we're looking at two potential storms making landfall early next week. Zoe, I don't know about you, but I can't even wrap my head around this right now.
A third and fourth disaster on top of the eviction crisis, since our courts have been open since mid-May, and on top of COVID-19, we're not handling these two crises well.
And then you have those who are still living in homes that have not been repaired since Harvey, and these storms out there churning in the Gulf, bringing more vulnerability. It's just too much to even humanly handle.
We were anxious about Hurricane Laura. It would sweep through the Caribbean and make landfall on the Gulf Coast a week later. It caused more than 40 deaths in the U.S. and almost $20 billion in damage in Louisiana and southeastern Texas. But on this call, our attention was focused on pressing for rent relief for people struggling to keep a roof over their heads during the pandemic. Houston has more than a million renters, so keeping those people housed would have an enormous impact on the health of our city. Zoe and I explained to Rose that we had been appointed to the city's Housing Stability Task Force.
We created an ordinance that wasn't perfect, but it was definitely going to protect more people than no ordinance.
What we wanted was a total ban on evictions. We came to the table knowing it would be a gamble, but we hoped the odds would favor the renters. We had never sat at a table like this before. Community advocates and Houston's politically powerful landlord lobby. When Houston's landlords pushed back, we knew we had to compromise.
And the mayor has sole discretion to put something on the city council agenda. The mayor just buckled down and said, you know, it was really felt to be a crisis of leadership for him.
I spoke with my city council member, Tarsha Jackson, about the mayor's decision. It went against the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control's advisory that landlords allow tenants to remain where they live during the pandemic.
The mayor's reason was that the CDC has a moratorium, so can't nobody get evicted anyway.
Do you know of particular cases of people here in the district that were evicted?
We did go to an apartment complex over in Greenspoint where the lady called. We see that they have eviction notices on people's doors. Mm-hmm. So it's like 3-day vacate mm-hmm. notice. Uh-huh. So I asked the manager, I'm like, do people know that they don't have to move, that there's a moratorium on evictions? And mm-hmm. she was like, oh yeah, they know. But if you telling me to vacate in 3 days and you saying I need to pay this amount that I don't have, then, you know, people would get up and just leave because they don't mm-hmm. know.
So people were self-evicting.
They were self-evicting, yeah.
So that way it didn't go yeah. to court. But right. at the end of the day, the landlord still got what they wanted.
Right, right. And that's why we have to do a better job. It's the city's responsibility. It's the elected, our leadership responsibility to make sure that people know, mm-hmm. you know, that they're getting this information.
What we witnessed was that the CDC moratorium did not stop most evictions in Houston. Zoe and others relied on data to publicize the constant stream of evictions, hundreds every week. Only 3% of the people going to court for eviction proceedings had any legal representation. There were tens of thousands of evictions filed in our county during the pandemic. The goal of a local ordinance was to strengthen the CDC moratorium, which we recognized wasn't strong enough. During these months, Rose was telling me that something really different was happening in parts of Northern California. She said at that time, in 2020, at the height of the pandemic, that some of the strongest eviction protections passed in San Francisco and Oakland.
We have one of the strongest protections now in the country, but a lot of the counties outside of us are kind of screwed. They wouldn't say no to eviction protection. It was people really bombarded their emails and their phones and were present at the hearing. People are really, really scared right now. The whole economy has kind of collapsed here and it's having a real impact.
Looking back, the protections we were so proud of winning in San Francisco only went so far. When the weaker California moratorium went into effect, it preempted our local law.
Meanwhile, as we worked on ways to prevent evictions and displacement in Houston, Zoe and I stayed connected with colleagues in Puerto Rico and the rest of the U.S. Zoe participated in an encuentro, a webinar organized by Ayuda Legal, the organization Ariadna Goudreau headed. You met her in the previous episode.
I see that there was a question in the chat. So Hilda asks in the chat, are some of the people that will be displaced Katrina refugees in Houston? Yes. In fact, one of the women that we worked with really closely on the apartment complex I mentioned that had flooded 3 times in 3 years was 13 when she moved from New Orleans to Houston. It's absolutely, there's a lineage also of disaster that we can talk about. All of these kind of compounding disasters that people are experiencing and compounding forms of displacement. What makes displacement so hard? It's this loss of culture and this loss of history, these loss of bonds as communities are flung apart, but it has a spiritual or soul element to it as well. And that is absolutely irreplaceable once it's lost or broken.
The conversation about displacement turned to strategies people were seeing to prevent it from happening over and over again in the aftermath of disaster. Zoe named one of the key challenges, how dull the government process can be.
It's not a joyous experience usually to participate.
And it alienates people.
And oftentimes, you know, the state is really telling you what to do, right? It's telling you to leave your home. It's telling you to, you know, evacuate or get flooded or be evicted.
An important role of community organizing is to transform and empower folks.
So if you imagine a neighborhood without flooding, like what does it take to get there? A backwards plan from that.
Organizing isn't just about being on the defense. It's about building a collective vision of what communities can be and figuring out how to get there. I've seen council member Tarsha Jackson come up with ways to engage people around issues that other elected officials seem to have written off as hopeless.
Flooding is really, really bad in our district. And of course, they never invested in the infrastructure. Every time it rains, I see a cloud in the sky. I get anxiety. And so the constituents, whenever it rained, we have them text us pictures of the flooding and we're documenting it. it ain't much raining and you see water bubbling up out of pipe, sewage. People shouldn't be living like this. I mean, we're getting somewhere. We just recently submitted a whole list to Public Works. I'm taking all of these projects, the long list of sidewalks, everything the district needs, and I'm going to my congresswoman, I'm going to my congressman, I'm going to these state representatives, and I'm like, y'all, we have to figure out a way to get the money, and I'm taking it to the mayor, too. Mm-hmm. We have to jump through hoops, just even to have a conversation about how we're going to get a sidewalk. The city refused to, like, invest the money where it needs to be invested, and that's in the people that need it the most.
In September 2021, I went to City Hall for a housing committee meeting. Councilmember Jackson had alerted me that a drama was about to unfold.
When I say laid it out,
he laid it all the way out. That's what, yeah.
He laid this out, girl.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's something that we've been fighting for years.
Chriselle recorded the meeting on her phone because she worried that the city would not make public what was about to happen in this public meeting. The city housing director sent comments outlining his refusal to go along with the mayor's support for a proposed development, where the mayor's former law partner happened to also be on the development team.
This briefing breaks my heart to give you because I've committed the last 5 years to working hard to serve Houston and to ensure that we are working hard to address Houston's affordable housing crisis. This administration is bankrolling a certain developer to the detriment of working families who need affordable homes. There is a culture of do it because I said so. That kind of culture creates the breeding grounds for corruption. I'm being forced to participate in a charade that this was a competitive process when I know it was not a competitive process. I don't plan to resign, but I do expect that I will shortly be relieved of my responsibilities here in at the city.
Councilmember Jackson.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you, Director, for just sharing your experience. It takes a lot to come out with this type of information. It is overwhelming, but again, thank you for just being open. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Councilmember.
The mayor immediately fired the housing director. The city had a process for considering proposals that would create the most affordable housing units. And the mayor circumvented that whole process and selected a project that didn't serve people who need that housing most. This was business as usual. But for the first time, a director spoke publicly and refused to support what the mayor had done. I'm cautiously optimistic that we're entering a new chapter in Houston politics for a couple of reasons. The housing director put his job on the line to demand transparency and accountability in addressing our city's housing crisis. And Tarsha Jackson's election symbolizes hope for so many of us. For me and my neighbors in Cashmere Gardens, it feels entirely new knowing we have a representative at City Hall who really knows firsthand many of the challenges we face. Almost 40% of the people in our council district bring home under $25,000 a year. Our young people have limited educational and job opportunities. It floods every time it rains. Our grocery stores don't stock healthy food. And the rest of our city treats our district like a dump, like for real. And these are the issues Councilmember Jackson takes to heart.
Councilmember Jackson understands her constituents because she is one of them. She was a single mom who became an advocate and organizer when her son got caught up in the juvenile justice system. He'd been diagnosed with serious mental illness, but he was doing well in elementary school until he reached the fourth grade. When he was just 10, his school administration had him arrested.
You know, and of course, as any mother, you're going to fight for your child. And started advocating for my son and other kids and started organizing other parents and just like really trying to change the system.
Councilmember Jackson worked hard to pass legislation that prohibits counties from jailing kids on certain misdemeanors and established the first ever Parent Bill of Rights. She helped return more than 2,000 kids home to their communities.
And you had leaders, everybody that's in office today. Mayor Turner was state representative, and nobody was speaking up. The state was getting paid $56,000 per year per child that they jailed, that they were warehousing kids across the state of Texas for money.
But you shut it down.
Yeah, we shut it down. They messed with the wrong system. Yeah. And we have to start investing in these communities.
You know, you've gone from advocate to now elected official. Mm-hmm. Now you're in there.
Girl.
And like, so what is it like now when you have advocates or, you know, that's trying to get something done?
There has never like really been no true partnership with elected official and mm-hmm. community advocates. And so I don't think we know how to do it. So I find myself like trying to call advocates to be like, hey, do y'all have any information on this? So, hey, do you have an expert to help with this?
Now that there is a true champion on the inside, advocates like me are trying to figure out how to make that work for us. We're used to playing defense, and I have to admit, I do it too. Another way Tarsha Jackson keeps connected is by riding her bicycle through the neighborhood. Not exactly a bike-friendly place.
I can see more. I take in more of the neighborhood. You know, I can, it's like, you can not only see it, but you can like feel it and you can breathe it and identify whatever would need to be done. But it also is an opportunity for me to talk to the constituents and talk to the people, the normal people that we don't talk to or elected officials don't talk to.
Do you have any particular like stories or something that's kind of sticks out in your mind? A particular constituent?
Oh, yeah. So I was riding up Gregg Street. People mm-hmm. just come and they put their lawn chairs out, having a good time. And so I go over and I introduce myself. One of the fellas told me nothing is going to change. And they get in office and then they don't do what they say they're going to do. So this was the one day. And then, you know, I rode again, ran up on him again. So he was like, all right, hello, Miss Jackson. You know? And so, you know, I talked to him. Then the third time I see him, he said, all right, councilman. All right, you got me. Okay, just let me know what I need to, how can I get involved?
The same day that the housing director was fired, I attended another meeting where people commented to Mayor Turner and the city council about their experience of our ongoing housing crisis.
I'm from Cashmere Garden area.
Yes, ma'am.
My mother turned 88 years old, and all she's asking you all, she like to live comfortable before she leave this earth. FEMA didn't do anything. FEMA only gave us $600 apiece because we had to evacuate overnight. You can't get in touch with the state representative. You can't get in touch with anyone. So I call upon you all.
We'll always see what we can do to assist. So make
sure.
You
would have somebody. I would love for somebody to come out to see.
Councilmember Jackson.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Ms. Hankins, for coming in. I want to work with you closely and work with the administration to make sure that, you know, your mom gets her home repaired.
Okay.
And when was the last?
In order to fight systems, you have to understand how to navigate the system. You have to. But if you don't know, then that's how you get caught up. That's how you get neglected. Our communities are crumbling because we don't know. Uh-huh. And it's our leaders that keep that knowledge from us.
Yes, knowledge is power. So is transparency. And just as we know that communication with local representatives is important, we also know that decisions at the federal level directly affect our neighborhoods. So Ariadna and I worked with the National Low-Income Housing Coalition to bring our concerns to a congressional briefing. It's important that two advocates who see how things play out on the ground could engage leadership at the federal level.
You know, it's been 3 years after the impact of Hurricane Maria, where 70,000 houses were destroyed. It's also been 9 months after and during several seismic events that have destroyed nearly 800 houses in the south of the island. We are able and we are responsible to foresee the consequences of disaster. You know, there's a lot of talk and romanticism speaking about survivors, speaking about resilience. But the reality is that there is thousands of people that will never be able to recover from disasters if something is not done from higher levels. I think it's important not to normalize how slow recovery is, not after Katrina, not after Andrew, not after Maria, and not now. In Puerto Rico, after Maria, we had a 60% denial rate from FEMA applications that left nearly 30,000 people without a roof.
There was recovery money, but it wasn't being used. Close to $10 billion for long-term recovery, and 2 years later, the local government had spent less than 2%.
We have to recognize the pervasive and inherent presence of structural racism and inequality in this system.
But as long as disaster recovery does not intentionally address the plight of people of color and those neglected during the last disaster and the ones before that, then we're going to continue to face a greater distortion in how communities truly recover. Recovery efforts must be intentionally inclusive, and equity must be explicitly addressed at all stages of response and recovery.
I think of that during my conversations with my Texas Housers colleague, Erica Bowman. Talking with her is a reality check for me about the ways these systemic problems invade people's lives. I recorded a phone conversation we had during that scary ice storm that moved through Texas in February 2021. It left millions of people without electricity, without heat, during record temperatures well below freezing. People died because of this, and during the worst of it, Erica went to check on tenants and offer support.
There's ice in their homes, pipes are bursting. They don't have anywhere else really to go. The shelters are completely packed. There's no food on the counter. There's no water in the stores. Still dealing with the pandemic, the children being home. This is just another level, another hammer thrown into their lives.
Mm-hmm. So this sounds like Hurricane Harvey, the winter edition. We slid a little bit from black ice, and that just terrified the girls. Oh.
The trauma that's happening from even the Capitol rioting and this storm and the pandemic. It's just really taking a toll on all of us. But I think about the kids.
So that's why I'm loving and hugging on them before getting back into the full grind of work.
Right.
I've definitely seen people come together more, but and I'm hoping that that will, you know, end up transcending into actual people power, political power that changes the dynamic, changes the structures that we see. And not by, you know, implementing a reform, but we have to tear this thing down and rebuild it all over again.
I have never been more sure in my life of anything that change is happening right now at a level that is desperate for it.
Erica's optimism and my own might seem misplaced given all the injustice we've described in this podcast, but here we were putting this story together in 2021 when I got a message from Erica with news about the lawsuit she and Zoe and Jamie told us about in the last episode. Erica was overjoyed that the 12 Moms group scored a win. They sued the Department of Housing and Urban Development over unsafe and unsanitary living conditions in the Coffer Tree apartments. You'll remember that the sprawling complex flooded regularly and tenants were plagued by water damage, mold, and sewage, among other problems.
Hey, Chriselle and Zoe, I wanted to make a special audio text for the two of you. I hadn't yet got to talk to you guys about this, the huge victory that just took place, of course, with Copper Tree. This Fifth Circuit ruling is pretty much saying that by law, you have no choice but to provide safe, sanitary living conditions to these tenants under your own regulations, by the way. It's announcing to the world of organizing, to all legal advocates, that now we can say when there's a notice of default that HUD has a responsibility of providing to tenants that are in these positions vouchers, an opportunity to move out of these properties. But I just wanted to give you a special shout out, sister to sister, that I love the two of you, and I thank you so much, and I hope all is going well for you.
Erica's 3 a.m. message was more than 10 minutes long. She made clear that this successful campaign rested on the tenants' leadership and perseverance.
This federal court ruling will have repercussions across the country. It means tenants, like Jamie, don't have to struggle with apartment managers who refuse to address public health nightmares, like the ones that threaten her children's health and quality of life, and destroyed her belongings again and again. It puts responsibility squarely on the federal government to provide decent housing to these families. Throughout this podcast, we've shared stories of people in communities who work together to deal with challenges when a disaster strikes and when government officials fail to meet human needs. from the lack of proper translation for alerts, shelters, and escape routes when firestorms ravaged towns as in Sonoma County, and to Texas and Puerto Rico, where mold and sewage spills destroy homes and the lungs of the young and old after deadly hurricanes. We hope you see the power of community and the cultures we come from. What happens when we all come together in collective action?
Our cultural histories are built from our ancestors who suffered enslavement and colonization. Because of them, our communities were able to prevail.
We do this work for our children, our young relatives, our grandchildren, our babies, for our future generations.
Like those before us did for us, their resistance made us stronger. And though we may not see the outcomes in our lifetime, we know that we continue building with each generation. I love what artist and author Adrienne Marie Brown says. All organizing is science fiction. We are bending the future together into something we have never experienced. A world where everyone experiences abundance,
access,
pleasure,
human rights,
dignity,
freedom,
transformative justice,
peace.
We long for this.
We believe it is possible.
Thank you for joining us on this journey.
I'm Amy Gastelum. You're listening to Making Contact. Since the original 2021 broadcast of But Next Time, a lot has gone down. For one thing, grassroots groups across the country, including some featured in the series, made a report outlining recommendations to ensure a more equitable recovery for future disasters. They named it But Next Time, Storm Survivors Demand Overhaul of Disaster Recovery System. And yes, they named the report after this series. In October of 2022, on the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Sandy, the report was released at a widely covered press conference. Joining survivors of recent devastating hurricanes, U.S. Representative Andy Kim took a podium to voice his support.
I've come to understand that every single day since then has been a tragedy for you, that this challenge has been unending, and that it has burdened you in ways that it should never have. Can I look at this list of recommendations? I've talked to you about the things that we can do. One thing keeps coming to mind, which is, why is it so hard? When something here, you look at this, it's common sense. What you're saying here, you're not asking for the moon. What you're asking for makes total sense. Total sense.
Many thanks to our guests from the project But Next Time. For more information, visit risehomestories.com.
KPFK wants to remind you that the National Weather Service has issued a red flag warning for Southern California. The red flag warning indicates that there's currently an extreme fire danger over Southwest California today, Wednesday, January 15th, 2025, until this evening. Please be sure to stay aware of your surroundings and be prepared to evacuate should an evacuation order be issued. Also, avoid anything that can spark a fire. Thank you, and please stay safe.
Hi, this is Robbie Krieger from The Doors, and you are listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and for the world at www.kpfk.org. Support free speech and freeform radio. Peace.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin.
So I don't have family and I don't have the resources. So when you don't have the resources, you have to go and find them.
We're going to go to Central Ohio, where a single mom's collective hosts a resource pantry.
We're just looking for resources that we can just give to moms with no barriers to entry, with no requirements, you know? And so that's what we're all about.
I'm Amy Gastelum. Stay with us.
Things like that, and now I'm shopping. This is the fridge. This is where we have all our veggies. As you can see, the veggies. I want some blackberries.
It's a sunny Sunday morning. Rugi Ingade sorts through a refrigerator stocked with fresh berries and tomatoes. This is the Motherful Resource Pantry. She's one of a handful of women helping to stock the shelves before it opens at 10. But she's also shopping.
We have a lot of things for evening nights. You know, banana fritters. Look at this. I love mushrooms. I love raviolis. I'm taking this home, you know, even a desert. Everything comes from Trader Joe's. We've got all of these to take home.
There are a few local companies that donate, but Rugi's right. Most of the food comes from Trader Joe's. They give away stuff they can't sell to local organizations. Motherful serves single moms like Rugi and their families. They know that having enough healthy food is especially important to kids' health and development. Here's one of the founders, Lisa Woodward.
Well, I'm super creative, and that's what I like to do is find ideas and think of ideas. I was a teen mom, but I was super good at finding resources. I see some younger moms that are just having a harder time to like maneuver the path. And that was never really hard for me because of just how good I am at just finding things. And so I like to continue that on, just finding more resources. But that's me. Like, I like to find stuff.
When they first started, Lisa and her daughter Ginger would wake up early before school to pick up the food.
And then we would drive back home and I would get her out and get her dressed for school, take her to school, and then bring the food to the food pantry and put it away. So that's the beginnings of it. And then we finally hired someone to pick up the food every day because it was getting a lot. But we're happy to have it. And it's all high quality, yummy food.
Motherful doesn't check IDs or pay stubs, and they don't ration what people can take.
We have tons of fruits and vegetables. We get a lot of meat and eggs, some surprises. Sometimes Trader Joe's will give us buckets and buckets of flowers, or we get a whole lot of asparagus at once. You never know. You never know. But it's all good stuff. And our moms volunteer and just help it keep going, our pantry.
Besides food, the pantry is packed with diapers and baby formula. There's detergent, shampoo, and even clothing. Black Lives Matter signs hang from the rafters. It's organized enough to find the essentials, but unexpected treasures like romance novels also surface here. Motherful's pantry is sort of like going to an auntie's house and searching through the spare fridge she keeps in the garage. It's almost 10, time to open for business. Some of the helpers take off, but the ones who stay are hoping they're going to see some babies today.
Hey, that baby deserves all the pictures.
Make her pink. That's what I'm telling you.
Love you too.
Hey, that baby deserves all the pictures.
The volunteers take a seat around a table, and they stay there until the early afternoon. Hearing them talk and laugh makes it cozy. Meanwhile, a young woman walks in.
What you getting?
Some whack because there's a shortage, so I'm just going to take a few.
Kay Riley stocks up on formula for her newborn daughter, Wisdom. Then asks a volunteer for help finding the right size diapers.
Excuse me, sir. Do you know what size these might be?
Which size are you looking for?
Newborn.
The smallest ones we got, right?
Yes. Just ones.
Yeah.
You can wear ones too, so that's fine.
Yeah.
On her way out, Kay stops when she sees a pile of books.
You gotten books from here before?
I have. I actually read one of them already, which is really good. And they have a book club as well. So.
Are you part of it?
I am not yet, but I tend to be after I get... I just had my baby, so after I get her settled with, I definitely tend to join their book club. They have a lot of good resources here. A lot.
She pockets a novel and heads to her car.
Would it be possible to sit in your car or my car for just a second to talk a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that okay?
Well, let me put this in my car.
Okay.
You can walk with me.
Cute purse.
Thank you.
Kay says she started coming to Motherful about 3 months ago, pretty late in her pregnancy. She's from a small town in Northeast Ohio, but she's in Columbus to go to school at Ohio State.
So, this definitely has been extremely helpful for me in my journey as a mother. So,
how so?
So, I don't have family and I don't have the resources. So, when you don't have the resources, you have to go and find them. And this has been a huge help. Not only, they offer diapers and all that good stuff, but they also offer community. And I think that's the most important thing, especially when you're a single mother by yourself. There's other single mothers that can relate to you. So I think that's the most important thing, that it offers community.
Some of the moms at the pantry today qualify for a government program called the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, also known as WIC. It's kind of like food stamps, but it's only for pregnant people and anyone whose children are under 5.
Are you using WIC?
I am. Yes, I am.
And what's that been like?
It's been very helpful, especially with a formula outage. It's still hard to find formula, but, you don't really have to worry about the price. That's been good.
Okay, full disclosure. I've been a public health mother baby nurse for over 10 years. I've helped lots of people connect with WIC, and my mom used it in the 1980s. But I had never used it myself until pandemic lockdowns. I didn't love it.
I had a baby not too long ago, and I was using WIC. And for me and our family, it was about like $40 a month, basically, was kind of what it equaled out to.
Yeah.
Which isn't huge, I'll be honest.
Not, yeah, that's true.
It's not, it doesn't cover all of your...
At all. But, it doesn't. I have to agree with you, but a little bit is, I'm still grateful for the little bit that it does provide, but it would be nice if they provide a little bit more, but.
Yeah. And then one of the other things that I found using it too is that it can be kind of complicated because you have to buy certain foods, and not every grocery store even...
Yes, I've definitely found that. Not every grocery store even takes WIC, and then you have to scan it, and then just a lot. I've definitely dealt with that. Just trying to find foods that qualify for WIC can be extremely hard and annoying.
I want to jump in here to explain what we're talking about. You can only use WIC to buy certain types of food. The idea here is that by limiting choices, WIC is guiding pregnant and parenting people to healthier food, like whole grain options. Also, participants have to make monthly visits to a nutritionist. That can be hard for busy parents. WIC sees itself as more of a health intervention than a food security program. And to be fair, studies have shown that WIC participants have less premature birth and low birth weight. But they have a big problem. Less than half the people who are eligible for WIC actually use it, about 43%. That's compared to 84% of eligible food stamps users, a program with much less restrictions and rules. It's difficult to know exactly why participation is so low, but as a user, I can tell you that besides the food restrictions and the mandatory visits, there's also a shaming factor.
And there were times when I would get to the register and the person ringing me up didn't really know how to ring up WIC.
Yeah.
And then it's like all your business is everybody's business.
Yes. It can be uncomfortable. That's happened to me, and they're screaming, well, I don't know how to use WIC. And they just scream out to the whole world. Why don't you just tell the whole world about my business? Why don't you? I think they definitely should train the individuals a little bit more on WIC.
Definitely confidentiality as well. Not everyone wants people to know that they're on WIC. That's just the honest truth. And they should be able to know how to use
because
it.
Because there's stigma. Yeah. Like, you don't know if the guy behind you in line is going to be like,
yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah, exactly.
For my tax dollars.
Yeah. And that's actually happened before with me.
So one time, Kay was shopping with her sister. They were at the register when the man in line behind them started to laugh.
And he was like, I'm glad my governmental, he said something about government, pays your food. And we just kept on walking. It was very uncomfortable for me. And I'm not used to that. So, yeah, definitely confidentiality. Not everybody wants the people to know that they're on WIC, but it's nothing to be ashamed of. Honest, I had to learn that. I had to humble myself and learn. It's not a bad thing. It just has a negative connotation to it, which is unfortunate because a lot of women do need WIC.
How did you convince yourself that it wasn't anything to be ashamed of? Where did that come from?
I guess it just came in from internalizing me and my own insecurities of using governmental assistance. Like, it's not, a lot of women use it, and it's okay to use it. Especially if you don't have the resources, what can you do? I didn't have the resources at the time, so I mean, it's nothing to be ashamed of. Nothing at all. You're a new mom, you're a woman, and I'm a single mom at that, so I'm just using the resources that they've given, you know what I mean? So,
which don't even cover your whole bill.
It doesn't even cover my whole bill.
Not even half.
Not even a quarter, I don't think.
Each state has their own restrictions and rules when it comes to WIC. And some of them don't feel like a health decision. They feel like a budget decision. In Indiana, where I live, you have to buy the least expensive eggs and milk available. You can get organic produce, but you're not allowed to buy organic shelf-stable food or organic baby food. And it can be hard for stores, too. Each grocery store that wants to be a vendor must stock a minimum amount of WIC-approved foods at all times. It can be hard for some local independent stores to meet that requirement, especially international markets. For them, most of the brands and types of food available through WIC are culturally irrelevant for their customers. Here's Rugi again.
You know, being an immigrant, it's a whole new process. It's like being reborn. You have to first unlearn and then learn. When you come here, you've got all kind of information. It took me a while to go through the right channels. I even thought if you take benefits, you will never be documented because they hold it against you. So it takes you a while to just realize that this is just for the child, you know. So I had WIC with my second child.
Rugi is Muslim and likes to shop at halal stores.
They don't take WIC, so it's a problem. I don't know what should be done. Small businesses working with WIC and working with all small business owners so WIC could be accessible to the people. They have to go to a regular grocery stores. And most of the time, when I first started, what I was getting wouldn't even work for me. But I still have just to take it and try it.
You're listening to a story about the single mom's collective, Motherful. In September, President Biden took to the podium to talk food policy.
Welcome to the White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
It's been over 50 years since President Nixon convened the original White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health. That single conference and the laws that inspired it led to transformational change that has helped millions of Americans live healthier lives for generations.
So WIC came out of that first conference and was up and running by 1974. Since then, lots of changes have been made to the program, but the changes have been to which kind of cereal, how many grams of sugar in the juice. Never should we really be dictating the foods pregnant and parenting people can eat? This year, even more program changes are coming, mostly to get people to sign up. You can visit our website to hear an interview with leadership at the USDA for more there. Meanwhile, the collective at Motherful is holding it down for single moms in Central Ohio.
We don't tell you how to vote, but we are an open, progressive nonprofit.
Here's Rugi again.
We support the Black Lives Matter. We support the LGBTQ plus community. We support all immigrants, no matter what their status is. We would support any woman, no matter what her choice is, but we are a pro-choice movement. So we're just an open movement, inclusive, that try to be also wholesome, not only work with moms, but try to take care of all the needs a single mother's family can have.
The food pantry is just one of the ways Motherful supports single moms. Their core values include reparative justice and health care for all. They host community dinners and bi-weekly Zoom calls with guest speakers. It's more than a place to find food or baby items. It's a politically aware hug around about 325 single moms and their families.
They're not being CEOs. It's mothers like us. We're all together. We are consulted at every level. It's a partnership. I have my own programs here. I get to have inputs and to say, this is what I want to see happen. And they make it happen. I make it happen. They give me the space, the voice. We talk. We decide this is something that is relevant, and we will do it.
Like I said, community is the best resource, I would say. Just community, knowing that others have went through the same thing I've went through, is definitely comforting.
What does that mean for you when you keep saying community? Like, what does that really look like on a day-to-day for you?
If you're feeling down postpartum, you can always ask a friend to, you know, go out. People still check up on me in the community, and not only that, they have an app for Motherful where you can tell your feelings and other women can, you know, reply and give you hope. That's what
have you been using that?
I have a lot.
In the middle of the night,
like, I'm feeling a little depressed. So
yeah,
but yeah,
I know about that 3 a.m. thing where you just wake up.
Yeah, that's like, what is this? No, it's a real thing. It's real.
He's like, where's my mommy?
Back at the food pantry, I sat down with Heidi Howes. She's co-founder and co-director of Motherful. It's time for her baby to nurse, so we settle into chairs in an upstairs room. Kids are playing, and somebody's vacuuming downstairs. I asked Heidi how WIC relates to Motherful's plan for food justice.
We do have a partner through WIC that we just recently connected with, who is a mom who works there. And so we're looking into it, but, you know, we're just looking for resources that we can just give to moms with no barriers to entry, with no requirements, you know. It's like, you need it, here it is. And so that's what we're all about. Personally, I may qualify for WIC right now. I'm not sure. I've had WIC in the past, but I actually didn't like WIC in the past because it was dairy and we don't eat dairy, or I don't eat dairy. But I know now they do have fresh vegetables, and that was something that I think I got on the tail end when my last child was born. But I haven't signed up for WIC now.
I was a teen mom, and I definitely took place with WIC for multiple times because I have three daughters.
Here's Lisa Woodward again. She and Heidi started Motherful together. I asked her how Motherful's resource pantry is different from the WIC program.
How is it different? This is a collective and a community. When I was going through the WIC system, there was not any sisterhood with other of the WIC clients. Our food pantry and garden, it's more free. You can get how much you need, and you can come multiple times. We don't have any like direct nutritional counseling like WIC has, but we do have moms that they share information all the time, just about healthy eating. There's also a lot of different local orgs that deal with nutrition. And so we're connected. So when they have programming, we do post it on our site. But we partner up with WIC for their farmers markets. So we were there. Folks were coming to get food, and then they would also find out about our programming too. And we look forward to tabling with them again as needed. Most of the people that come through WIC are new moms or pregnant moms. So that's really good for us because most of our moms have are not adding to their family. And so it's good that we have those, can help those moms too that are new moms that, and you're a single mom. That's like a double, that's a double whammy. So we encourage those connections.
If you could imagine like food for single mothers, someone such as yourself, like in your wildest dreams, like what would you want for someone in your position but from the government?
I would say like for a period of time, just covering, I would just say like at least half of the expenses. It can be extremely hard. I'm not saying if you're working and if you're able to work, I would say half. But if you're not able to work, I feel like due to you having a child and stuff, I feel like the government should assist mothers, single mothers, especially when they're single. You can't go to work because you just had a baby. I think they should.
Some people call that unpaid labor.
Meaning, when
you're taking care of your baby, it is work, right? Like you're working.
Yeah, that's exactly.
You don't get paid.
That's exactly what I was about to say. Even not even having the baby, just carrying the baby itself, having to worry about your fat feet and then everything else that comes with pregnancy. That's hard work. That is extremely hard work. Having to deal with the insecurities of your body after. That's hard work that you have to do internally. There's so much components to pregnancy, even after pregnancy, that women have to deal with. That's work to me. That's work. So
yeah,
that's labor for me.
You know, the ultimate dream would be like every household has a garden. Like there's a gardening committee that comes to your house and puts the garden in, and it comes every week and helps you weed and teaches you. And then also fresh, healthy food is delivered to mom's houses, period. Preferably cooked. That's actually what we would love to do here at Motherful, is to have prepared foods that we can just give to moms, because it's impossible to do all of these things, you know, as one person in a family. And why not, you know? So bring the fresh, healthy food right to the doors of moms so that they can, you know, take a bath instead of cooking that meal, you know? Because it's really, really hard work being a mom, you know, raising children, and you're sore, your body hurts, you know? just need a minute to rest and decompress, and so you can be in, you know, your full state of love and care to give that to your children, you know, because if moms are good, everybody's good.
Yeah. Just the highest quality of produce and the prepared food thing. That's definitely high on my list, and just someone to help our garden just multiply.
I'm a type. It's, yeah. I never.
And that's organic too?
No, that's
organic. Back in the garage, everybody packs up for the day. Rugi likes to check in at the end to see about the tomatoes. If there are any left, she takes them home.
It's Sunday. So I ran out of tomato paste, and today I want to make somebody.
Oh, yeah.
He needs a lot of tomato. I make everything from scratch.
Our ultimate goal as an organization is to build a co-housing village here in Columbus, Ohio, and then to take the model of the Motherful organization and build chapters throughout the world, you know, so that other moms can be empowered to work together for better lives for themselves and their children, and also ultimately to uplift the matriarchy. Yeah.
I just see that mothers in power with each other and others, as opposed to power over, which is a patriarchal model, you know, if mothers are in power, like, people are going to be loved, they're going to be fed, they're going to be housed, they're going to be clothed, they're going to be taken care of, you know? And it's just, it's a no-brainer. So if we can get moms out from under the invisibility and out from under the straight-up slavery of reproductive labor and get them into leadership, you know, while they're also being taken care of, you know, and bring children into our common spaces again too, you know, I think that that's going to change the world when moms are running things. It's going to be so much better, and it's just a matter of time.
You seem convinced.
I mean, don't you see it
coming up next?
You know, it has to happen. We can't, I mean, it's that or destruction. Absolute destruction, you know, unless we bring the matriarchal ways back into the forefront. And by that I mean valuing life, valuing the sacred life of all, and love and nurturing and care and interconnectedness and all these things that, you know, colonialism, capitalism, patriarchy, white supremacy, all these things that have been suppressed and killed and due to those powers. Like, when we bring back the matriarchy, when we bring back the matriarchal ways, then we'll be able to save our planet and save ourselves. So it has to happen, or else it's death, you know? Matriarchy is life.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and via the Stitcher app on your phone, too. Thanks for listening.